Hi, this is Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. I'm joined today by Catherine Mangu Ward. She's the editor-in-chief of the print magazine of Reason, and Matt Welch. He's editor-at-large at Reason. Catherine, thanks for joining us.
Hi there, Nick.
Matt, good to have you.
Guten Morgen.
And on Mondays, we talk about politics, culture, and idea of the past week and of the next week, of the coming week, from a libertarian perspective. Let's get right to it. Catherine, one of the big stories that refuses to die is about Mike Pence saying that he, Vice President, Donald Trump's Vice President, that he doesn't eat meals alone with women who are not his wife. Is this a story that we should be talking about, and what are the stakes here?
I tried desperately not to care about this story for as long as humanly possible, but I have given in and now officially care. I was finally baited into caring by the Federalist Molly Hemingway, who I like and also think is wrong about lots of things. And she tweeted, to much acclaim, "Didn't realize your career advancement required so many boozy private dinners with your opposite sex boss. Mine required literally zero." As the two people on this call know better than anyone else, mine required a bunch of boozy dinners with my opposite sex bosses, both of them here on this podcast.
Wait, but did did they require?
That seems.
I mean, you guys can hedge all you want. They were highly beneficial to my career, and not just with you guys, but also just to have the personal leeway to say, "Let's go out after work for a drink," has in fact clearly been beneficial to my career. And I think it's weird that people are so eager to generalize. Like, why would Molly think that her career is representative of even people's careers that are extremely similar, adjacent to hers, like mine? I get that feminists are grumpy that the dudes won't have dinner with them. I get that Christians are grumpy that they think, you know, the libertine ways of our society have overtaken culture. But it strikes me as super weird that this is now on day six of a thing.
Matt, do you think, I mean, is this primarily, it's a, you know, and I don't even know if it's hidden, it's a culture war story where you have Mike Pence standing in for middle America, good American values, traditional cultural values. He's a conservative Christian. He's a Republican. He's from Indiana. And, you know, people from the elites or the coasts and liberals say this is unbelievable. And as Catherine was suggesting, it also means that in a Pence office, women are not going to be able to get very far because it's kind of the way people would talk about how, like, when golf clubs didn't allow women and the men would go out and, you know, play golf together and do business, it would by definition exclude women. Is that what this is about? And if so, is it all just bullshit? Because is female advancement in general, is it threatened, or is it proceeding apace, regardless of the Mike Pence's of the world?
Well, first of all, I'd just like to issue a correction to Catherine. Mostly it was boozy lunches, if we're being honest.
That's a good point. Yeah, I accept your correction. It was clearly lunches. And there's actually been some sub-discussion about whether or not this only applied to evening events. I have seen commentary on that issue. So
very, very important. This whole thing, which I, you know, there's two categories of tweets that I don't publish. One is irritation at subway buskers, and the other is delving into dumb culture war issues to say you people are dumb for talking about it, because ultimately that's a pretty dumb thing to say anyways. But this reminds all of us that near the beating, fleshy, bloody heart of politics is really a strong human desire to isolate, hermetically seal a group of other people and feel superior to them for your own completely kind of like social moray type of reasons. And this is absolutely happening on both sides. It's the, you know, I can't believe what kind of he's buying into rape culture by assuming that all men are beasts and women are these objects of nonstop kind of lust, hair trigger. First of all, this is like a 15-year-old story, right? And it's not even a direct quote, if I have this correctly, and I'm trying really hard not to look on the original link material. And then you have the overcorrection, including, very irritatingly to me, not just Molly Hemingway, but Matt Walsh, who gets into a lot of culture war things that which I'm immediately blamed on by, like, I can't believe Matt Welch said that. This is conservative who who had said basically the same thing Molly Hemingway did about 2 weeks ago. He had said something about how this passage in the Bible proves that we shouldn't give to the poor, and I got a ton of heat on Twitter for it, even though I don't talk about the Bible. But no, it's all about this sense, how can we feel superior to you people? And it's gross. It's the vice president's. Right, it's what the vice president does internally in his own marriage for whatever reason, and what he said about this 15 years ago. Who gives a flying shit? I mean, if we're going to be talking about the mores about a marriage around power, I'm more disgusted by Donald Trump, saying in front of his wife, bragging to a reporter that he never changed a pair of diapers. And even then, compared to everything, none of this matters. But people don't have that sense of actual tolerance of, hey, look, you know what? Marriage is complicated. People's lives are complicated. And if it's as long as it stays out of our business, who gives a shit? It doesn't matter at all, as far as I'm concerned.
A question. Why do they call it a pair of diapers, even though it's just one?
They do not. Only Matt does.
Did I call it
okay?
A pair?
Yes.
I think you called it a pair of diapers, yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know, maybe two, you're double bagging for safety, Matt. I think you're right, Matt. Catherine, I hadn't thought about it in terms of the generalizing from your, one's experience to everybody. That's kind of interesting. I do want to leave open the idea, though, that you shouldn't have to, and I don't think people had to, but you don't have to socialize, right, with your bosses in order to succeed. There's that. But then it's also true, these weird strictures of saying, okay, well, you know, this or that is the proper way. It seems, Matt, we are in a golden age of people really feeling smug and arrogant, and that and I guess we've been saying this every year for the past 20 years, but that it's not enough that you can just disagree with people. You really do kind of have to put them in a full Nelson and beat their face into the pavement with your moral superiority, your epistemological superiority, your theological superiority. And it's, how do we get around that anyway? Because it does. It's not getting better. It's like every year it seems to get worse and worse, where it's really about showing I live a better life than you, and I think your ideas are stupid, and I think you're stupid and beneath contempt. Because you get that in this case, I think it's mostly kind of liberals ragging on conservatives, but you get that a lot with people like Newt Gingrich throughout the 90s and 2000s until he finally had to shut up for various reasons. They were incredibly morally smug. They were talking about, remember going back to when Newt Gingrich was talking about how when Susan Smith, I think her name was, killed her kids in South Carolina, he said that was democratic values, even though she was a registered Republican. But, how do we get out of this kind of dank conversation?
I think it would be great if the stakes were lower, right? I mean, one reason everyone is losing their mind about who Pence has dinner with is because so much power is concentrated, even in that shitty vice presidency, that one dinner could make a huge difference. It could be a giant subsidy to a specific industry. It could be the difference between a big tax cut or a big tax increase that has very strong impact on a person or an entire category of people. It doesn't matter so much who has dinner with whom if we can't bully each other around all the time.
That's a pretty good That's a pretty elegant solution, answer to that question.
I would also just add, which is not quite an answer to your question, Nick, but it's something worth chewing on, is that there's a liberal world flip side of this on college campuses. I remember when my wife's brother was out here teaching at Brandeis, he's a French guy, for a semester. He couldn't be in his office with a female undergrad with the door closed. And that's a pretty normal. And that's 15 years ago or 10 years ago or something like that. That is kind of normal on college campuses. We have this kind of puritanical assumption about, rape culture just lurking right underneath below everything. In fact, Laura Kipnis, who Catherine did a pretty good interview. Was it Catherine? Was it me? Someone. Well, we all did good interviews with Laura Kipnis at some point. But she's got a
It's like Murder on the Orient Express. It turns out we all interviewed her.
She's got a great essay out right now in New York Magazine, which is an excerpt of her forthcoming book on this, talking about this kind of cultural change on college campuses that is of sort of the basic climate of sexual hysteria and where it leads. And it's the inverse of this. And it's, you know, it's instead of the guy who's very worried about his own sense of propriety or whatever Mike Pence's thought balloon is on this, you have entire campuses and rules associated with it, just kind of assuming that there's going to be a nonstop hum of predatory behavior out there. And it's ridiculous. I mean, the thing is, it's just...
Don't you think that's true, though? I mean, I can tell you. No, well, I mean, that, you know, maybe it's a question if we keep overcorrecting from one thing. But, you know, I was when I was working on my dissertation in the early 90s, I had, like, some of the older professors, and they were always dudes. And, you know, they started teaching in, like, the late 50s, say, or something. They would talk in an unguarded way around men that was, I mean, beyond creep. Factor, you know, it was like creep factor 10 about like where other like there one guy said like his department chair like essentially offered his daughter to the guy, and this was part of the culture. And it was, you know, everybody, it was funny because anybody who was under the age of about 40, male or female, was like, God, that is fucked up. And like the guy wasn't expecting that at all. And, you know, I think it's good to get rid of that kind of weirdo culture. But maybe, you know, then it goes too far, then it, that creates an overcorrection, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't know.
Yeah,
let me put it this way. So a friend of mine, and again, this was at SUNY Buffalo. I'm not naming names, but one professor said, oh, you should, to a female friend of mine who was working with him on a project. And he actually said to her, you know, you should come by. I'm going to be working in my office until about 7 o'clock tonight. You should come by and you should always knock first, because sometimes I sleep in my office and I always sleep in the nude. And like, you
what?
Know, it's just kind of like, you know, that shouldn't, maybe it shouldn't be legally actionable. Right. But it's kind of like, you know, you're kind of, you know, that's kind of fucked up behavior.
I didn't realize we're segueing into Bill O'Reilly, but go on, Catherine.
Let's not ever segue into Bill O'Reilly. I mean, this is, you know, I had my senior thesis advisor. Every time I met with him, the door was sort of aggressively opened and like sort of waved around in the hallway. I think, you know, I was aware that that was what was going on, but I always sort of had this weird vibe that, you know, he wasn't the threat. I was the threat, right? I mean, I think that's the element that is kind of underappreciated or under-discussed in this. You know, the idea that 19-year-old female undergrads are like major legal risks for these powerful men is like, that's not a healthy mindset. That's screwed up, particularly since, you know, the vast majority of 19-year-old female undergrads want nothing to do with that old mess. So I think it's like there's a piece of it there too that you're sort of signaling to women, like, you are dangerous. You are, you know, keep that apple to yourself, Eve. And that's a lot of what was in the last issue of the magazine, you know, this idea that while the physical risks of sex are way, way down, the legal risks on so many fronts are way up. And if that's what Pence is reacting to here, you know, he's not crazy, but it's still, there are still negative implications of it, and it's also not crazy to talk about those.
Yeah. And, well, it's also good that it's, you know, I mean, this is something which I think at various points feminists, and, you know, that's too broad a term, but like people who are in favor of the status quo, where women have much more workplace, you know, I think power and ability to move up the ladder and all of that kind of stuff. It we're always so slow to admit that things have gotten better. And so, you know, the Mike Pence thing, as Matt was saying, from 15 years ago, and as a paraphrase, that's the same as, you know, like a casting couch situation at Columbia Pictures in 1934 or something, as opposed to things actually are getting better, and that there are these really, you know, brutally slow social learning curves, though. I remember when women really started reentering the workforce in as equal to men with college degrees and whatnot in the 70s and 80s, I can remember some conversations of my parents. You know, it wasn't that they were necessarily against it, but it took them a while to even understand what it meant and how that changed workplace culture, which I think in general is better than it used to be and more welcoming overall.
I mean, it's all, if nothing else, it's a shout out to the interesting power of the TV show Mad Men, which that was basically the subtext of all of it is how did we get from this culture, you know, that we've decided existed in 1964 or whatever, to the culture that we live in now. And the actual existence of that show was part of the kind of sealing of that transformation in the same way, which we've talked about before, although this might seem a bit of a stretch, in the way that the Supreme Court ratifies where society went 10 years ago. Sometimes pop culture ratifies that in a sense too. And so we learned to be like finally, you know, exclamation point horrified by what were pretty normal social mores in the 60s and 70s, and now which just aren't possible. And you see this every time there's a new rock memoir, right? Like, because it's going to talk about what people were doing in the 1970s. There's a big flap, I think, with, was it Joan Jett and the Runaways? There was some related book that came out last year and talking about who was sleeping with who in 1977 and at what age. And everyone was freaked out about it. And then Chrissy Hynde from The Pretenders came in and sort of said, hey, look, this is how things were back then. And it's really interesting and strange and dislocating to apply our current morality, which is a much better morality, as you rightly point out, Nick, onto something that happened in our living memory and lifetime of it was so different even 40 years ago. And so there are these little moments like, you know, the Bill Cosby kind of moments where you see those two things collide at once and everybody kind of freaks out and they wash some major cultural figure down the drain, and rightfully so, who acted monstrously for a long time.
Well, there are also real degrees. I know with the Runaways, it was that one of the former band members said that she had been drugged and raped by Kim Fowley, their manager, and a lot of people watched, including she claimed other members of the band who denied it. And so that's, you know, that's certainly different than, you know, just kind of a out of control but not necessarily felonious action by, you know, Led Zeppelin or Deep Purple. But then the Cosby stuff is orders of magnitude beyond. That's like the Jimmy Savile stuff in England where a popular children's show host was a pedophile. And apparently everybody knew. And actually, you can go back and see snippets of Johnny Rotten and other people in the 80s talking about that Jimmy Savile is a pervert. And it just nobody gave a shit. Speaking of perverts, let's talk about Big Bird, because this is another culture war story that is getting gigantic press. People are defending Trump's so-called skinny budget, gets rid of funding for the National Endowment for the Arts, National Endowment for Humanities, cut stuff to Corporation for Public Broadcasting and National Public Radio, which led Nicholas Kristof, who is, you know, the most reliable pundit to come out with the dumbest thing on almost any given topic, writing in defense of Big Bird. Matt, are you swayed by Nick Kristof's ardent defense of Big Bird, of public funding for Big Bird?
No, not at all. I would just point out, even before, you know, get into the philosophy of Big Bird, is how much this cut is not going to happen. We are in an entire month where we're going to have a phony conversation or a very heated conversation about cuts to government that are not going to take place. So the 30% cut in the Environmental Protection Agency that Trump proposed in that budget, it is not going to happen. The 21% cut in the State Department, Department of Agriculture, those are not going to happen. Look at the actual reporting going on about people when they talk to actual Republicans in the Senate, who are kind of the whip hand here. Susan Collins says it's too late. It's too late this year to have cuts like that. That's next year's budget. So, you know, and there's a budget deadline at the end of this month, another, you know, mini cromnibus to a continuing resolution to keep the budget going forward. None of these cuts that are being discussed in the Trump skinny budget are going to be part of that. Maybe, you know, a couple will be fought over, but for the most part, they're going to haggle over it and then at the last minute have a must-pass bill, which probably the only feature that we can safely predict in terms of big change is that it's going to spend more money on the military than what they did last year, because that's what everyone, especially Republicans, really wants to do. So these are all, we're going to have this great theoretical conversation. And yes, on the theoretical conversation, absolutely, for crying out loud, why would we subsidize Big Bird? Is that even on PBS anymore? Isn't that safely an HBO show?
Yeah, and it also has a merchandise, or the Children's Television Workshop had an incredible merchandising deal with PBS or CPB, where they got all the revenues basically from all of the merchandise. All of us have kids. All of us have kids with a lot of Sesame Street stuff. It's a classic case of the idea of this is a property that did not need to be funded by the government, or if it did at one point, certainly does not depend on government funding for survival. Catherine, this is one of those places where I find libertarians are often, we're shit out of luck, because I love the arts. I love the humanities. And I think it's really stupid that we're funding them the way that we do. And that it comes down to, as Matt was saying, this ridiculous conversation about always killing Big Bird, when it's never even going to happen.
I would say the analogous thing is whenever there's any cut in any budget anywhere, it seems like teachers and firefighters are immediately fired, right? I mean, it's like, a single dollar is removed from any budget, and it's like, well, there go 100% of the arts educators in this state. And I think, it's very obvious what's going on here is that the people are choosing the kind of, charismatic megafauna in this case, I guess, puppet charismatic megafauna to point to and say, don't you love this thing? This thing will go away. I actually find in these discussions, though, that at least in D.C., in the kind of, circles of people who actually traffic in these things, everyone understands that the PBS debate is fake. They understand that the PBS is not really going to get cut. But it is a proxy for a real debate, which is whether or not government should fund things just because they are good things that should exist, regardless of whether they would exist otherwise or in what form. And that is a real fight. I think that's the place where libertarians have trouble, because we have a very strong absolute answer on that question, which is almost always no, and certainly no in cases where private sector would provide. And that's not most people's answer. Most people's answer is much squishier than that. It is much softer than that. And whether the thing is Big Bird, or whether the thing is, soup kitchens, or whether the thing is
basic medical research type of thing.
Medical, yeah, right, mm-hmm. Like pure science. There's something that people want to give on, where I at least almost never want to give in.
There's also a flip side to this, in that Nick Kristof piece in particular. He goes from talking about Big Bird, Donald Trump is going to deport Big Bird, get it? And then he says, but the humanities are really important. And he's blurring the, whatever monies went to Big Bird, which is a fucking kid show that has been shown to have absolutely no educational impact. It was sold as, it's going to help ghetto kids, learn how to read faster. And it doesn't do that, whatever else you can say about it. And there's no form, if Joyce Carol Oates are the three saddest words in the English language, public television or educational television are the two saddest words in the English language. And but he goes to the humanities. And one thing that is fascinating to me, and I say this as somebody who's really interested in the humanities, are in free fall in universities, because people who do literary studies, cultural studies, history, a number of social sciences that blur over into the humanities, have spent the past couple of decades railing against American society, railing against their own studies of objects of study as irredeemably racist and misogynistic and capitalistic and red tooth and claw. Nobody takes them anymore. And I know a couple of people at universities where they started teaching 30 years ago, and the school would have maybe 1,000 English majors, and they're down to 50 because nobody fucking wants to take the class, not because they're not interested in literature and not because they're not interested in how we explore and analyze and project and think about what it means to be human across time and society, but the classes are so annoying that it turns people off, because you're constantly being told this, and all of these other things that supposedly made us human are actually signs of terrible, terrible crimes of the past, and that we shouldn't be studying them. Even as people like Mark Cuban and people, other entrepreneurs are talking about how people who do the humanities, people who have a sense of history, have a sense of synthesis of information and knowledge, who are good critical thinkers and critical readers and critical communicators, that's what you need for the future more than any specific competency in a particular kind of mathematical function or whatever. So it's very frustrating all the way around.
Nick, can I since we have an academic on this phone call, and it might be an interesting point to think about, is the rise of kind of popular culture studies on campus, is that a way to kind of sidestep that? Because I presume if you're studying or teaching pop culture, it ends up being more positive because America is at the center of any pop culture story, and it sounds more fun in a lot of way that people when I was in school started gravitating away from English and going towards film because film's kind of interesting and you get to have more serious discussions about things and it isn't always about colonialism, although sometimes it is. So is that kind of a reaction to that that's more on positive, or am I just inventing that?
Yeah, I think you're right that a lot of it is the approach, and there, very, very broadly speaking, I think there are two approaches to kind of studying literature, and this also includes history to a good degree, which is that you use it to figure out what were people talking about and how were they talking about it. And so this is something like you take somebody like John Milton, who is one of the great dead white men. In British literature, and there's actually a pretty strong case. Like more and more American universities are kind of like, why do we teach so many classes in British literature? When we're in America, America has been the hegemonic power for 100 years, et cetera. But putting that aside, Milton was surprisingly feminist in many, many ways. He was involved. He was Cromwell's minister of tongues and actually wrote, kind of came up with the argument for chopping off the head of Charles I. Very political, but very classically liberal in most ways. And so there's this, there's a lot of political stuff to talk about with Milton, which would make him kind of current. And you can do that if you approach it that way. What were the terms? What was going on? Who was influencing him? And it turns out there were a lot of women preachers who actually, their thought filters into it. You can do it that way, or you can always be using culture. You see culture as a means of kind of repression or of guiding people to a kind of stupefied ignorance where they're a false consciousness almost in a Marxian analysis. And with that, then things like popular culture are the worst because they're current and they're happening now and we're supposed to be better than this. But, this would be that Mad Men, the reading of this map would be that Mad Men doesn't give us distance from the past and understand how things have gotten better. Rather, it reinscribes the past and actually transmits pre-modern or pre-liberation attitudes towards women and injects them back both into men and women who are then more likely to act that way. So you can go either way.
As the kids say, all your faves are problematic.
Yeah. No, and so a lot of it is the approach. And I think one of the things that's happened, which is really interesting in academia, is that a lot of the people who are interested in things like literature and cultural studies, they're evacuating the university or that part of it because they can't really have the conversations that they want and they can't really create the knowledge or communities that they want. And then you see in some things like, I think, film studies and film UCSB, Matt, where you went, has always had a phenomenal film program and drawn a lot of people. But you also see it now in places like interactive media studies and things that are blending kind of technology and critical analysis in a different field where there just isn't as much of a backlog that you're kind of working through. Speaking of, I guess it's not a backlog, but Catherine, I have on my sheet of topics rockets, and this is a good news story, right? Private rockets.
This is a good news story. I have to resist the temptation always when I'm looking for something good to talk about to just sort of look up whatever Elon Musk is doing today and crow about it. But last week, SpaceX launched a reusable and reused rocket, retrieved part of it by landing it on a drone barge. This is some pretty cool sci-fi stuff that is happening right now. The big upshot of that, of course, is that it gets us a step closer to cheap space travel. If you have to build something that costs millions and millions of dollars and then light it on fire and drop it in the ocean every time you want to go to space, that is not a viable economic system. Musk has been much derided for his efforts to build and deploy reusable rockets. And I think people are pretty much agreed that this was a real proof of concept. Obviously, he's not all the way there. He's been saying for years he wants 24-hour turnaround, that you pull a chunk of this rocket back out of space and pretty much immediately reuse it. So that's what's next on the list. He's also saying that he's now moving on to a heavy lift rocket, which will be just a more powerful one that can kind of go further than the International Space Station, which is where these guys are going now, either ISS or just putting satellites up. So just a really cool story, and I think an example of the sort of surplus that accumulates when you have insane billionaires with tons of money to burn, which is, those guys are villains in movies. But this is pretty freaking heroic.
Do you do they celebrate Cinco de Mayo on the International Space Station, or are they still working through that?
Well, it's like depending on which, they could probably celebrate it for as long as they want. They could catch it at whatever point in the globe they want to join in.
So where do we go with these rockets, though? Because, so you go to the International Space Station, then you hang out there, and then is that where you stage a Mars landing, or do you – when do we actually start living in space? And other than the kind of, that would be really pretty fucking cool. But what is the value? Is there a particular goal, or is it more like just let's reach the stars and see how it changes us?
Musk is very clear that his goal is Mars colony. He said over and over, I was born on Earth. I want to die on Mars, hopefully not on the point of impact. And he seems to behave as if he thinks that is actually a possible reality. The International Space Station is just what's there now. And so not only is that where there was a contract available to service that thing, which SpaceX got along with other private space companies, but there are a bunch of firms that are working on 3D printing in space, and that's frequently paired with asteroid mining. So, to my mind, part of the next phase is figuring out how to build stuff off the surface of the planet that will get us to the next phase, because we can't – that's the hardest part. The hardest part is getting the hell off the face of the Earth.
I just want to get to Mars before Starbucks does, and they ruin it all by commercializing it.
That's not going to happen. Mars is like Havana. It's like they have all these cool vintage cars there, but you'll never get there before it commercializes. So just go ahead and – go ahead and accept that.
Matt, do you have a strong interest in living in space?
Oh, God, no. Only in the sense that I have a strong interest in keeping my marriage as happy as Mike Pence's marriage, and my wife really wants to go to space. So
won't Emmanuel let you eat dinner with me alone? Can you talk to her about that?
She's known you for long enough, Nick. I think that says it all. No, space is we need options, as Beck famously sang in 1995. We need options in this world, and space is an option. I feel like now more than ever, I'm going to go back to the same Robert Heinlein books I read when I was 14 years old, just because the world feels like it's kind of degenerating on us a little bit, and that was always kind of a through line into what he was saying. You need options for the crappy systems that we are surrounded by.
Will there be any good songs about space travel once we're actually doing it? Because certainly, when there's at least a handful of great songs about spacemen and the loneliness of space, et cetera. What will be the free bird?
Space is
the
about
Mars
to get
colony.
Really crowded, though, man.
Yeah,
there's going to be no. I think we can just substitute any song about the Western frontier. I think there's going to be a resurgence of terrible Manifest Destiny style country music.
I'm hoping
only
it's
with space.
Kind of like Bob Seger, and it's those sandstorms on Mars are giving him chills, like the Hollywood Hills or the Mars Volta. Matt, tell us about the Freedom Caucus.
Right. So President Donald Trump, starting late last week, started just dissing the Freedom Caucus, which is a group of about 30-odd members of the House of Representatives. We don't actually have a total headcount.
Odd being the key word there.
Very odd, including people who are so odd they won't join, like Thomas Massie, but he'll generally vote for them. It's headed up by Mark Meadows. Justin Amash is one of the co-creators, a Republican from Michigan, who is arguably the most libertarian-leaning him and Massey, I think, in the House. And Trump started, rag tweeting at them, by which I mean the way that we used to talk about ragging on people in baseball, not any other connotation of the word, saying that, the Freedom Caucus, we need to defeat them and the Dems in 2018 in order to, get the policies that we want. He's positing them as the only reason why the Obamacare reboot or the Ryan-care didn't pass, which in itself is odd, right? Because this thing was approved or had a popularity rating out there in the public of 17%, right? There hasn't been a piece of legislation, major legislation, this overwhelmingly unpopular that I can recall in my lifetime. To be more unpopular than Obamacare itself was takes a real effort, and it cleared that bar by a lot. And what's funny about that is, let's pretend for a moment that all the Freedom Caucus guys would have lined up and signed the bill. We still don't know, or approved it, we still don't know whether the moderates out there, including a new to me, horrifying sounding group called the Problem Solving Caucus, which is half Democrats and half Republicans who want to just get together and get things done, and they're being bankrupted by bankrolled, but also morally bankrupted by no labels. So just hashtag the shit out of all that. So we don't know if it would have passed, but even if it had passed the House somehow with all that support, it would have failed in the Senate. Not only did the Rand Pauls and Mike Lees come out and say, we're not going to vote for Obamacare light, and I think Ted Cruz too, or who knows exactly, but Tom Cotton, right? So other people, for other reasons, were not going to support this. So it's just a really, really odd fight that Trump has taken. Then his social media guy in the White House, Dan Scarvino or something like that, came out and started trash-talking Amash and saying that he needs to be defeated, and this maybe violates the Hatch Act or some goddamn thing that I've never read. But it's an amazing thing to do, because the Republican majority in the House of Representatives right now is 34 members, right? So if there's 30-odd members of the Freedom Caucus, you've run out of your majority in a hurry. And then if you look at who are their analogs in the Senate, where there's only a four-person Republican majority, well, Rand Paul, who of course played golf with Donald Trump this weekend, which is weird, Rand Paul, Mike Lee, you can maybe throw Ted Cruz in there, you run out of bodies. And so it makes you wonder, what the hell is the administration thinking? What are they trying to do? They're signaling in a lot of different ways that, especially with the infrastructure bill and then possibly also with tax reform, they want to reach out to Democrats. Well, that's interesting in theory. Who is the Democrat right now that says, you know what? I think I'm going to start working with Donald Trump. That's what's going to happen right now to me. That's how I'm going to defend myself. I don't see a lot of evidence that there are Democrats out there. And we've seen already with their approach towards the infrastructure bill, a $1 trillion idea that Donald Trump has. They're unhappy that he only wants to spend about $200 billion out of that from the Department of Treasury. They want all of it to be spent by the government instead of just a huge and unaffordable chunk of it. So it's this weird thing. Trump is taking what already is a pretty narrow kind of a group that might follow him anywhere legislatively after a big defeat, and he's narrowing it still further. So it's a great reminder, not only of his strategic incoherence, but that who is going to ultimately be the most threatening to a guy who is kind of all over the map ideologically, it's going to be people who are operating from a position of ideological principle. And as it happens, a lot of this overlaps with libertarian principles. So it's going to be a very interesting conflict for all of us to follow going forward.
Catherine, what did you bring for lunch today?
I brought freedom for lunch. That's what I eat. Yeah,
I have it every day, 6 servings. But to Matt's point, though, what are the upsides? I mean, one of the things that and Matt, I agree with what you're saying, and this is, I don't know. It's very unclear how the Republican Party puts together any kind of legislation. It seems that will get signed, because Democrats want to spite them anyway. So even if they agree with it, they might not vote for it. But then there's the Trump is also showing with some of his certainly some of his cabinet secretaries, some of his rhetoric, a couple of executive actions about actually cutting or stopping the implementation of pending regulations. He has at least talked about, if it's not a net spending cut, at least he's talking about cutting something. Is there what can we say that is positive, not that we have to, about Trump? And is he making certain things possible by actually saying, no, we're just going to cut this?
I mean, I think the tweet from 4 days ago perfectly captures probably the last, I don't know, 2-3 decades of the relationship between the Republican Party and libertarian-leaning legislators or humans, which when he tweets, the Freedom Caucus will hurt the entire Republican agenda if they don't get on the team and fast. We must fight them and Dems in 2018, right? So it's like, you're on our team, right? You should be a team player. Also, fuck you. We're going to fight you. Don't make me fight you, bro. And it's like, it's right. It's the same tweet. It's part of the same tweet. It's not even a minute apart that he's having these two clearly contradictory thoughts. And that's what it's like to be a person who, you know, has vaguely libertarian principles. And I think most of the guys in the Freedom Caucus, you know, that word is, at least in its broadest sense, applicable to them. And to look to the Republican Party as a home, as an ally, as someone, as a place where you can get work done, you know, on some level, I guess I appreciate that Trump is essentially saying, screw you guys, I do what I want. But still, there's that little tantalizing, we got to get them on the team. And he could, right? I mean, I think that's the thing that's weird here. And this is what you alluded to, Nick. He's doing stuff these guys like. He's doing stuff I like sometimes. And it's weird that he's chosen to rhetorically position himself as someone who will defeat the Freedom Caucus, at least the majority of the time, rather than someone who will try to incorporate those views in order to make his position stronger.
Do you guys think that it's he, Matt, you had said, you know, that kind of strategic incompetence or something along those lines. Do you think it's simply that Trump doesn't know what he's doing, or that he knows what he's doing and it's just his strategy isn't making sense? Because he is a political neophyte. I mean, he's never held office. He's never really – he's never talked in a political setting. And, you know, you realize that, you know, congressmen and presidents and stuff, they're saying all kinds of coded messages. They know how not to – you know, not to say certain things when they appear to be saying exactly that.
Well, I think it's easy to imagine, and I try really hard not to let Donald Trump live in my head on this stuff, but it's easy to imagine, given the distance, there's actually quite a fair amount of distance between what Donald Trump said were the values that he cared about in a healthcare bill and what actually came out. And he didn't seem to be that involved in the cobbling together of the legislation. Didn't really sell it. He just kind of twisted arms and had a loyalty test. And so it's easy to imagine that he took the approach of, all right, Paul Ryan, we'll give you one. See what Republicans can do here. We'll give you this one. And if it's the same dysfunction that we have observed in the Republican Party for a long time, and if you can't cobble together something that's popular, I'm going to pivot. So here's your one. He did it. It totally blew up in his face. Nobody liked it. And so he's going to pivot. And part of what he said in the original kind of mini press conference after the thing went down was that, hey, look, Democrats are going to have to come to me to write the replacement of this when they notice that that the existing system is not working. It's failing for their constituents. So I can see his mind perhaps thinking of, not only did this fail, so we'll have to pivot towards this on the bill itself, but also now come the two big things that we believe we can get some Democratic support on, especially infrastructure. They've always seen this as a way to buy off Democratic votes, particularly in places like West Virginia, Michigan, places where Donald Trump did a lot stronger than expected, and have had economic problems and such. So that, and then they think they're telling themselves that tax reform, you know, the aforementioned problem-solving caucus was the first kind of caucus that the Trump economic team went for in to have the initial conversations with about tax reform. So you can, it makes sense on this kind of broad look at it. However, the reality on the ground, as we see with the Neil Gorsuch confirmation process, is that all the pressure on the Democratic grassroots side is to just obstruct everything right now out of a basic rage. And I hope you guys haven't watched enough TV to watch various Democrats come on and talk about the Gorsuch things. I wish I remembered the guy's name. There's a Democrat who was on CNN who managed within like 60 seconds of talking about why he was voting against Gorsuch to name check the Koch brothers, climate change, and the Russians too. So like, as long as this Russian thing is going on, we just can't afford to have another. So they're just throwing everything at the wall in opposition right now, and that is not a climate in which it makes sense for Democrats to play ball with Donald Trump on major big ticket bills. So I can see vaguely how he's approaching this, and it sort of makes some amount of sense, but I don't see how he gets from there to actually peeling off a Democrat unless he decides that his infrastructure bill is just really going to be a half a trillion dollars of pure pork in Democratic fingers.
Which it almost certainly will have to be, right? I mean, it's, infrastructure isn't going to – I mean, if it's government finance or financed by government debt, it's not going to help the economy. All it can do is help individual people who get a check.
Right. There's a lot of hope because there's good people from the libertarian point of view who are in and around the Department of Transportation and also within Trump's cabinet who are advising him on transportation. And there's hope. People like Bob Poole works for the Reason Foundation on transportation for the last several decades, that if you change some rules and allowed more private capital to come in and finance this stuff, then we could actually see a private sector financed infrastructure, boom in the country. However, Democrats are dead set against this. There's at least as an initial starting bid, they seriously say we want all the money to be spent by government on this. We can't just have, you know, these insidious Australians and Spanish people, paying money to refurbish and maintain roads. So it's his gambit, and maybe it works, but it's hard to imagine that. And as you name checked earlier, Nick, I mean, the same Freedom Caucus people that he's going against and their analogs in the Senate, they are precisely the hardest core of the ones who are going to be cheering on Trump's otherwise deregulatory agenda of cutting agencies and rolling back regulations and all this kind of stuff. So it seems like an incoherent approach.
Catherine, are you looking forward to anything particular this week in terms of a story that you're covering or you're finding interesting?
I guess looking forward is probably the wrong phrase here, but I'm keeping an eye on
anticipating with dread.
Yeah. Venezuela. I've just been, following further the story in Venezuela, which, there was basically, the parliament was essentially dissolved at the end of last week. And it has this incredibly weird throwback feeling to me. And I suspect that I'm not the only one who has this sense that it's just so perfectly following the pattern that we all learned in school of why socialism doesn't work and eventually leads to violence, starvation, and death. And it's like somebody heard that story and was like, yeah, let's try it one more time. And here's Venezuela. And, you know, we've been covering some of what's going on there in the magazine, both just in terms of the direct story from a piece by a guy named Francisco Toro, who was the editor of the Caracas Chronicles and now lives in Montreal because Venezuela is a terrifying place. Also, of course, Jim Epstein's amazing piece about how Bitcoin is keeping some people fed in this otherwise totally dysfunctional economy. But the extent to which it just gets worse and worse and it's such a predictable way. I'm finding that I don't have a lot to necessarily add to the commentary. There are certainly people better informed than I am, but it seems like a story that everyone should be looking at just to remind ourselves that this is how it goes.
What do you think from a libertarian point of view? When we tend to be non-interventionist and whatnot, but what could either the U.S. government or what could individual libertarians do, if anything, to help, the people in Venezuela? And I also think it's a different setup, but it's also very alarming what's going on in Turkey and the way that Erdogan, who, not so long ago was seen as one of the most progressive or forward-looking and modernity-friendly leaders of a Muslim country, is becoming a true despot. What can we or what should we be doing either as a country or as individuals to help people in those situations who, through no fault of their own, really are just fucked on the horns of history? Is there anything that we can do?
There's one very important thing that the U.S. government could be doing, which is not giving any fodder to these corrupt leaders who want to blame the U.S. for the fact that their people are starving. And that narrative is very powerful in Venezuela. Maduro says, you're starving because the U.S. is preventing trade. They've blockaded us. They're stopping people from sending us supplies. That idea of the sort of U.S. as, you know, great Satan or whatever boogeyman you like, as the root of misery in these countries, is very easy to spread. And it's easy to spread because the U.S. does sometimes impose punitive trade sanctions. We do that all the time. And, you know, I think having a policy in which we say we will always trade with nations regardless of their political leadership because we think trade is something that free people should do with each other, I think that would be huge because it would at the very least remove the rhetorical stance that these guys take when they sort of point at the U.S. and say, oh, it's not my fault, it's their fault. And then I think, you know, stuff like this story that Jim covered of just, you know, private charity, helping people help themselves, in particular, you know, sending medicine. People in the U.S. are really good at that, and we always have been. We're lucky, we're rich, we're free. There's no reason that we shouldn't be doing that sort of targeted charity privately where we can.
Well, I think we will leave our conversation today there. Thank you, Catherine Mangu Ward, Editor-in-Chief of Reason Magazine.
Thanks, Nick.
And Matt Welch, thank you, Editor-at-Large of Reason. Thanks for talking this morning.
Thanks, Nick.
This has been the Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes. Rate and review us while you're there. I'm Nick Gillespie. Thanks so much for listening.